Welcome, everybody. As you have no doubt inferred, I am not Joe Salerno. I am guest lecturing this second lecture for the Mises Academy course, Understanding Monetary Chaos. And I thought, given the relative expertise the different people associated with the Mises Institute have in various topics, I thought for what this course is teaching you guys, I could contribute the most by giving an overview of some of the other main schools of thought, at least in today's policy debates or internet debates, if you will, and how that relates to the standard Austrian take on these matters. So if you're following the syllabus that went along with this course, like if you went to the main Academy website or then logged in, my understanding is that Joe is going to cover all that stuff. But he knows what I'm telling you guys tonight, and thought this was fine. Okay, so as you can see, we're going to study three main rival or challenges, let's say, to the standard Austrian view. And just to give you the big picture tonight, this is going to integrate the Austrian take on both monetary theory and capital theory, because you'll see that in practice, those two things often go hand in hand. Also, just some bookkeeping or housekeeping, I should say, in case you're not familiar with my style on these sorts of things. I'm going to try to time this to go until 45 after, and then the remaining 15 minutes, I'll try to answer your questions. So obviously, if you have questions about what the stuff I literally talk about tonight, that's fine. And or if you have just general questions about what this course is covering, I can try to field those as well. But keep in mind, Joe didn't want me to necessarily cover the readings that you guys did for today. So it's conceivable you could ask me something and I'll say, I have no idea. All right, so let's go ahead and get started. So let me first just set the context. I want to make sure I don't lose anybody with the sorts of things I'm going to talk about tonight. So this guy over here is Roger Garrison. On the off chance that you guys don't know who that is, this is Roger Garrison, and this, of course, is Keynes. So there's a sense in which the Austrians do not even subscribe to this normal dichotomy between micro and macro. Okay, that if you take a standard economics course, whether it's the undergrad level or even in graduate school, they will often bifurcate economic theory into micro versus macro. And even if it's in a standard course where there's a sense in which even the micro stuff is very non-Rothbardian, you know, there's all kinds of math and it's marginal utility is expressed in terms of cardinal units, and they're dividing price by marginal utility and equilibrium. And that's so all sorts of things. You know, they're talking about perfect competition and what's oligopoly and what's monopoly pricing in various industries and things like that. And it's a lot of stuff that would make a Rothbardian recoil in horror. And yet, there still is a sense, even in standard mainstream mathematical neoclassical economics, where the kind of things they're talking about with microeconomics looks like normal economics to an Austrian. And really, it's more the objection would be, well, just the techniques you're using to get across those concepts we think are unrealistic and maybe misleading or confusing. But there still is a sense in which micro talks about scarcity and the importance of prices, and how that they help allocate resources, and how is it that a decentralized market process works. Okay, those sorts of things still make sense in micro the way it's conventionally taught. Whereas in macro, it's like everything gets flipped on its head. All of a sudden, you don't even talk about prices, really. Now it's just big aggregates. And especially if you're talking about what Paul Krugman and others refer to as the liquidity trap, it's not simply that the normal things you study in microeconomics get obscured, but they actually, the standard results get flipped on their head. And so that, as Krugman would say, in a liquidity trap, it's like looking through the looking glasses, you know, Alice in Wonderland, everything's upside down. But all of a sudden, if people try to save more, the economy tanks and everybody becomes poor. And if you follow him, you'll know that stuff that's really counterintuitive, he thinks is true using conventional macroeconomics when you're in a so-called liquidity trap. All right. So that distinction, what I'm trying to get across here is to make sure you guys realize outside of the Austrian school, it's not merely that, oh, micro studies small things, or like the individual firm or the individual consumer or household, and macro studies big things. It's not just that the subject matter is different. It's that the very techniques they use are qualitatively different. And often the principles they employ are not just different, but they're mirror images of each other. So that things that are normal principles that, oh, if you want to produce more in one industry at the micro level, well, then that takes away resources from other industries, and so there's a trade-off. That kind of stuff in standard conventional macroeconomics gets flipped on its head. And that's where you get stuff like the multiplier where, oh, if the government just runs a deficit and spends more in industry X, not only does that not reduce output in other industries, it actually boosts it. Okay, and so that's the idea where it's standard things that would have come from standard, what you might call classical economics, just get totally reversed. Okay, so that's what happens in mainstream economics. In contrast, in Austrian economics, there isn't this sharp demarcation between the two different types of economics. In fact, some Austrians don't even like the term macroeconomics. They say all economics is microeconomics if you're using that terminology, the way that mainstream economists use that term. Some Austrians go so far as to say, as a sort of symbolic protest, just like they might not use GDP, just the very idea of that notion they think is so wrong-headed that they don't even want to give it the dignity of referring to it. By the same token, some Austrians don't even like the term macroeconomics because it sounds like you're saying there's two kinds of economics, one set of principles or one body of theory that you use to analyze the market for laborers who work at fast food restaurants, and that's micro. And in that kind of world, you know, you use your minimum wage analysis and stuff like that. But, oh, if we're talking about macro and things like inflation and unemployment and the business cycle, then we're supposed to use macroeconomic theory, which is totally different. So the Austrians reject that altogether. So you'll find that theme running throughout the Austrian school. And one way I like to describe what is it that Ludwig von Mises did in his classic work, The Theory of Money and Credit, is to say that Mises actually unified micro and macroeconomics. Okay, because even back then, but at the end of the 1800s, economists had developed two different sets of analytical tools. Okay, so let me just don't worry, we're not gonna stay in the history of thought too much, but I really want to make sure you get this point because it sort of ties together a lot of themes that you'll see Austrian economists stress. And so I want to show you it's not just that they had their little pet peeves or something, or their hobby horses. This really is a consistent worldview that it all fits together. All right. So remember, the classical economists had a cost theory of value or a labor theory of value. They were related. And then you had this so-called marginal subjectivist revolution in the early 1870s, of which Karl Menger, the founder of the Austrian school, was, by everyone's account, not just the Austrian, everyone's account, Karl Menger was one of the pioneers in the marginalist revolution that gave us what we now call subjective marginal utility theory. And that's the way you explain prices. Okay. So economists ran with that, and they realized that, yep, this is a much better way to explain market prices. But what they ended up doing, let's say towards the end of the 1800s, is they had two different types of explanation. If you wanted to just explain relative prices, relative prices, meaning like how many oranges does one apple trade for? Does an apple trade for two oranges, or does an apple trade for one orange? That sort of thing. Relative prices, or how many hours of labor does a horse trade for? If you're just trying to say things have value in the marketplace, and what are the relative values, just looking at the goods themselves without thinking in terms of money, just looking at real, so-called real goods exchanging for each other. That economists explained using the new subjectivist marginal utility approach that Menger had developed, and that also Jevons and Walras had sort of independently developed at the same time, roughly in the early 1870s. Okay, so those three guys all published important works, and economists realized, yeah, this is a much more fruitful way to explain relative prices. Instead of saying, oh, well, it takes more labor hours to raise oranges than apples, so that's why oranges trade for, you know, one orange trades for two apples in the market. Instead of going that way and looking at how much labor is involved, they started from scratch and said, no, it has to do with consumer utility, and that's the place we start. Okay, so that was great. So using those techniques, they could explain why in equilibrium one orange trades for two apples, let's say, or a pound of oranges trades for 2 pounds of apples. Okay, great. But then when they wanted to explain a totally different approach, they used what you guys, if you've studied economics, have heard of as the equation of exchange. And so they would do things like say, well, it has to do with the total quantity of money and the velocity of circulation and the average price level and the total number of transactions. So you'd get things like MV equals PT. You may have seen equations like that or learned those. Or sometimes you'd see it P times Q, okay, where M is the total quantity of money and V is the so-called velocity of circulation, meaning how many times on average does a piece of money change hands during a period of time. So we're talking about the U.S. and we're talking years, you'd say M is the total number of dollars and V is saying on average how often does a dollar bill change hands during the course of a year. So the bigger V is, the higher the velocity or the turnover of the money in the economy. Okay, so N times V is the total expenditures, right? And then what's P times Q? Well, P is the average price level, and Q is the level of real total output. And so if you think about that, well, the price of an average good times the total number of goods is the total amount spent on produced goods that year. So that's why it's an equation. You can see why, if you define the terms and you think of it the right way, the left side equals the right side. And that was the way economists would explain absolute money prices. So yeah, they're marginal, individualistic, subjective utility explanation would explain why a pound of oranges trades for 2 pounds of apples. But then if you wanted to know, okay, but does that mean a pound of oranges goes for $1 and a pound of apples goes for 50 cents, or $1 trades for 2 pounds of apples? Or does it mean a pound of apples costs $10 and a pound of apples costs $5? You see how that works? That the subjective marginalist explanation just explains the relative prices, but to get the absolute dollar figures, economists use a totally different apparatus. Okay, so what Mises did, among other things, in the theory of money and credit, is he merged those, well, he didn't merge them, he he showed how the subjective marginal approach could also be deployed to explain the market exchange value of pieces of money. All right, so let me just say that one more time, different language, to make sure you get the point, and I'll move on. But one way that I like to describe to other economists when they wonder, like, why do you often care about this Mises character so much, is I'll refresh their memory and explain to them the state of economic theory before Mises' book came out. And the mainstream economists who've been trained at Ivy League schools even, they will recognize what I'm saying because that's what they do to this day. That's how they think about it still. There still is this bifurcation of micro and macro, where you use micro. Let me put it this way. Don't worry. I'm going to come back and finish the train of thought, but I just wanted to really make sure you guys see what I'm saying here. If you go into, especially in the graduate work in economics, but even if you just take like a more advanced undergraduate economics course, you might do something like an Edgeworth box diagram, if you guys have seen that. And so there's lots of, or I know you can use indifference curve analysis. Okay, so all sorts of cute little geometric techniques that you'll see in like intermediate micro books at the undergrad level or beyond if you go to grad school. Those are all clever ways of showing how economic principles, if you really push them mathematically, can lead you to build little hypothetical model economies and figure out what the relative equilibrium price ratios are. And that's micro. But there's no money in those economies. There doesn't need to be. There's no reason anybody in those economies would ever hold money. It's just apples and oranges and trees that, you know, create more apples and that sort of stuff and labor, right? And those little simplistic models, nobody holds money because you don't need it. It'd be silly. Everybody just directly bet. So they're barter economy. And so mainstream price theory to this day, and the stuff that I learned at NYU, it was all barter economics. It was like taking, you know, the sort of insights that Menger had in the early 1870s and just dressing up with a lot of fancy math. But it hadn't moved theoretically beyond the way Menger would have talked about a barter economy and how do prices come about, okay? And so, but they want to be able to give advice to central bankers, right? Like the macro guys at NYU certainly have all sorts of stuff they want to tell Ben Bernanke or now Janet Yellen. So they can't have a model that's literally barter. They got to put money in there somehow. So they just throw it in as an afterthought. And they have to kind of arbitrarily make people want to hold money. Okay, so Mises didn't do that. In the theory of money and credit, he just said, look, we have this theoretical apparatus that Menger developed and Bavarck refined and Beezer and so forth. And so now I, Mises, am going to take this theoretical apparatus. We all agree as economists, how would you explain in equilibrium why a pound of oranges trades for 2 pounds of apples? We all agree on that now. So Mises is speaking like in the early 1900s, let's say. Okay, we're all agreed on that. Yep. And Mises is saying, okay, so now I want to take that same theoretical apparatus and use it to explain a pound of oranges is going to trade for how many German marks. Why can't I do that? You see, in other words, he was just treating money as unit of a commodity. And he was saying, why don't we use the same apparatus? If we all agree how you would explain oranges trading against apples, and ultimately has to do with the margin of utilities, which is a subjective thing, let's do that with money. And so notice, if that worked, if you could come up with if a solution popped out of that, you'd be done. Because to explain a pound of oranges trades for how many German marks, if you're in Germany, you just would have explained the price, the money price of oranges. That's what it means to say, you know, I mean, maybe they would do it in kilograms, but you get what I'm saying. Okay? So that was on the one hand, it's so obvious, like, duh, you tell me a economist didn't think of it. So I'm not going to get into it now because I think probably Bill might talk about it or somebody else in a different lecture. But that's what Mises did, and he just explained how he did it. And the reason economists didn't go that far wasn't that they were bumbling idiots. It's that when you first try to do that, it looks like there's a big problem, logically, that there's a stumbling block, because why would people – it's obvious why people subjectively value apples and oranges, because you eat them, and they satisfy your hunger, and they taste good, or a lot of people think they taste good, and you can make pies with them and stuff. Okay, or a dessert. You don't make orange pie. That'd be gross. All right. So that's duh. It's no problem to start at the explanation and say, well, people get utility from apples and oranges, and then if you just think about that for a bit, you can see why in equilibrium they would trade in certain objective ratios. But when you're trying to explain why would I trade my very tasty oranges in exchange for pieces of money, yeah, you could say, well, because I subjectively value them, but the reason you subjectively value the money is that it has purchasing power. That's why you value the money. It's not because of what it's going to do for you directly. It's because it helps you buy stuff in the market. And so the economists before Mises were worried that they might just be arguing in a circle if they tried to use the new subjective marginal utility approach directly to explain the exchange ratios in the market between so-called real commodities versus units of money. All right, and so Mises and the theory of money and credit, among other things, solved that problem and showed them, no, it's not a circular argument, don't worry about it. What that ends up being, and I'm not even going to tell you what this is, but just to give you a hint, that's what the regression theorem has to do with. The regression theorem is involved with that train of thought. So probably some of you have heard that term at least. So this is related to that. Mises, in order to solve this problem, ended up deploying what we now refer to as the regression theorem. Okay, so I see somebody's concerned about the audio. I'll try to speak louder, but I don't think there's anything I can do systematically to make that better, unfortunately. Here, I guess I'll turn up my mic. Okay. Then is now to come back to the big train of thought that I was getting at with this slide originally. So you see what Mises did there, beyond the narrow problem of just explaining money prices. What he did was he integrated what other economists back then and now to this day had previously split up into two separate things. On the one hand, they were explaining relative prices using marginal utility type arguments. And then when they wanted to then talk about absolute price levels and things like that, they used a whole different theoretical apparatus. And so notice, like this MV equals PT or MV equals PQ, depending on the version you're using, it's not just that that's different. It's that doesn't even look like Mengerian economics. What the heck is that? That looks like physics. Not that there's anything wrong with physics, but it's not economics. You see how methodologically that does not look like microeconomics. Okay, and so if you read Man, Economy, and State, I mean, Rothbard just goes through and systematically blows this equation up and just shows that it's nonsense and that it's qualitatively different from the sorts of things you do when you think like an economist, at least since the Mengerian approach. All right, so Mises, that's why I say he unified micro and macro, that he showed it's the same body of economic principles or techniques, the same way you explain the relative exchange ratios in the market of apples, like a pound of apples against a pound of oranges. That same analytical framework or apparatus is what you use as an economist to explain a pound of oranges trading for how many units of money. And then, you know, you think about it, you've just explained money prices. And so if you want to then explain what economists typically mean by the term inflation, and what Austrian economists, especially in the Rothbardian tradition, would be more specific, and they would say price inflation because they would be clear about what they're talking about, that to distinguish monetary from monetary inflation, meaning expansion of the quantity of money and or credit, depending on the author, as opposed to a rise in some price index, which is what a lot of people today mean when they say the term inflation. Okay, so if you understand how that works, you don't need this whole different theoretical apparatus. You can just say, no, I know what makes individual prices move, and so I know what makes, if you wanted to define something and call it CPI or call it the GDP deflator or whatever you want to do, I can tell you what makes that thing move as well, because I know what makes individual prices move. All right. Last thing here on this general introductory slide, if you want to do macro from an Austrian perspective, and that's certainly what Roger Garrison specializes in. What Garrison calls his approach is capital-based macroeconomics. And so for Garrison, he thinks that's the distinctive element of Austrian macro, if you want to use those terms. And we'll see as we go through this the relevance of that insight. But I just want to make sure you get that up front, that for Garrison, he thinks that it's the reason the Austrians end up having such a unique perspective on the business cycle and on economic growth and things like that, things that are typically handled in the study of so-called macroeconomics, is that the Austrians have a very rich capital theory. Okay, I will move on. Obviously, like you said, if you have questions on this stuff, just go ahead and put it ideally in this Q&A box. You should be able to type directly in there, and then at the end I'll try to turn around and field those questions. Okay, so let me spend a little bit of time now explaining to you. Hang on, let me just jump ahead here. Okay, I don't want to get mixed up. This is what the next slide was. Okay, so this school of thought, if I had to pick right now, let's say we're having a strategy session, I'm assuming most of you who are taking this course are fans of Austrian economics. And so as a card-carrying Austrian myself, when I look around at the different types of approaches other economists have, to me, the biggest threat to the growing popularity of Austrian economics, the thing that would most derail what I saw as the progress that Austrians were making in getting their views out there and being discussed, is not Keynesianism. All right, because the kind of person who is going to start reading Paul Krugman and get drawn in and think, oh, wow, this guy makes a lot of sense, and I really like his style, and oh, you know, you just, he makes it so clear why the Fed has been too tight and why we need to have bigger deficits and why a carbon tax would be such a great idea right now. I mean, this is, and why we need more spending on infrastructure. I mean, this is so obvious. Yeah, if an alien invasion came, that'd be great. Okay, somebody who's going to go down that path, it's not that, oh, if only we had reached that person 6 months earlier with Henry Hazlitt, you know, we would have had him. It's not like Anakin Skywalker going one way or the other. That's not what's going to happen, right? The kind of person that's going to end up thinking Paul Krugman is great and being a diehard Keynesian probably never would have liked what modern Austrian libertarians have to say anyway. All right, I don't want to be completely cynical, but let's just be frank about that. In contrast, I have seen lots of people who started out as Austrians and then now and abandon that and now consider themselves market monetarists. Okay, so in case you haven't heard this term, let me just make sure I don't lose you. It's a fairly new term. In fact, I saw it get coined in real time, as it were, that this guy, Scott Sumner, if you had to pick one single person right now who is the lead representative of this new school of thought, it would be this guy, Scott Sumner. So he's at a relatively small college, Bentley, he's been around for a while. He's been publishing at least since the 1980s, and his blog is themoneyillusion.com. So he's a very intelligent guy. He can back up his arguments. I have said many times, I think if I debated Paul Krugman, I would quite easily beat him, you know, as long as I had a week or something to prepare and I didn't have jitters or something, that I would be able to beat him. Whereas Scott Sumner, I'm not sure I'd be able to beat him in a public debate unless I had a long time to prepare, because Sumner, he's got this very intricately developed worldview. It's hard to catch Sumner contradicting himself. I think he's totally wrong, but it's like, you know, he's developed this internal story, and it's hard to find a chink in his armor. And he can back it up with all sorts of facts or whatever, and he's a very formidable debating opponent. Whereas I think Krugman, it wouldn't be too hard to, you know, to point out, wait a minute, you said this 2 years ago, and now you're contradicting yourself. Okay. So my point is, if you're curious about this, by all means, go ahead and read themoneyillusion.com to see where this guy's coming from. Now, this term market monetarism, where are they getting this from? Well, the monetarism comes from the fact that their inspiration is the old school monetarism of Milton Friedman. All right, so Friedman is a monetarist, and he famously said that in one point in his career, at least, look at inflation, by which he meant price inflation, significant price inflation, is always and everywhere a monetary phenomenon. And he thought what the monetary authorities, the best they can do is not screw up things through the monetary tail. Okay, so you can't fix real problems with the economy by tinkering with the money supply. And this is Milton Friedman's position. And so don't think you're going to be able to do that. So like if there is a recession, generally speaking, Friedman would have said you're not going to fix things just by printing money. That if the government has really bad policies in place, just printing up money is not going to fix that. It's just going to make prices rise quickly on top of whatever the underlying problem is. All right, and so Friedman famously advocated, at least at one point in his career, that the optimal monetary policy would just be to commit beforehand, just announce to the world, we're going to have the total quantity of money grow by a certain percentage each year, no matter what. And everybody can bank on that, no pun intended. And so we're sort of taking the monetary volatility off the table. So individuals don't need to worry about that aspect of things. So in addition to everything else you got to worry about as an entrepreneur or as the head of a household trying to make long-term plans with, is the government going to raise income tax rates down the road? Are energy prices going to rise? Is there going to be a recession? In addition to all that stuff, you don't want to have to, on top of that, worry about, is the government going to debase the currency? It's just, there's one more thing I got to worry about. Well, no. Friedman's saying, if you knew, no matter what, whether there's a depression or whether it's a boom, if the government always had, let's say, M2 grow at 5% per year, guaranteed, well, people would adjust to that, and then you find the so-called Phillips curve trade-off would get better. All right, so the Phillips curve. Handwriting's bad. That's a PS. Phillips curve. That is the alleged trade-off between unemployment and price inflation. So that's it underlies a lot of the Keynesian mentality, is to say if there's a recession and unemployment's high, the central bank ought to increase the rate of money creation, and then that will cause spending to rise, and we'll get more price inflation, but it will lower unemployment. On the other hand, if price inflation is running too high, if the economy is overheating, a standard Keynesian analysis, especially like old school Keynesianism, like of the 1960s, would have said, oh, you can fix that easily. You just jack up interest rates, slow the rate of money creation, and that you'll nip that price inflation right in the bud. Of course, you'll get a recession. Okay, so there is this trade-off. And so Milton Friedman and others, especially this sort of merges into what was called the rational expectations revolution, they challenged this idea. And they pointed out, well, this so-called Phillips curve is not stable. It moves over time. So if the government just kept printing money every time the economy hit a hiccup, yeah, that might temporarily lower the unemployment rate, but then the workers and everybody would adjust to that, and they would start expecting higher rates of inflation. And so the monetary authority would have to keep inflating more and more to get a little short-term dip in the unemployment rate. And so the Phillips curve, if you plotted it, would start moving over time. And so that's the sense in which so Friedman was saying, instead of playing that game, just commit to a rule that says the quantity of money, and I think he picked M2 when he was formulating this stuff, just make that grow at a certain percentage each year. All right. For our purposes now, it doesn't matter. He had a whole theoretical argument for how you would pick that number. So it wasn't arbitrary, but one aspect of the argument was pick some number and stick to it. And then if you said, okay, Milton Friedman, given that we're going to do that, what number should we pick? Then he could say, well, that, you know, it would make more sense to pick 5% rather than to pick 200% per year, and or per, you know, shrinking it by 12% a year. Okay, so, but for our purposes right now, and for why these guys are called market monitors, that's the essential insight that Friedman realized or taught, that if there's underlying real problems, if there's structural problems, if there's bad government policy, you can't fix it by printing money. But you can mess things up by printing too much money. All right. So it was more like a do no harm approach. Incidentally, you guys might be wondering, you know, Bob, what are you talking about? Didn't Milton Friedman famously say the Great Depression was caused because the Fed didn't inflate enough? And yes, he did. So I'm not saying these two things are consistent. I'm just telling you everything I've said up till now is true about what Milton Friedman said and why these guys are – this is what they're talking about. All right, so I guess partly to explain it, and you'll see even the market monetarists in a minute, we're going to get into their diagnosis of what happened in the Great Recession, is that there was inadequate monetary stimulus. Okay, so we're going to see that same perhaps surprising twist. But I just spent all this time explaining to you why Friedman was saying don't screw things up with the money supply. I was to warm you up to try to get you to see where he was coming from. I was focusing on don't screw things up by printing too much money. But on the other hand, he also thought it could screw things up if the government printed too little money. All right. Okay. And so the point of committing to a fixed regime of growth was, Friedman thought, that will help anchor everybody's expectations. And so in the long run, that's the best way to try to ensure we don't ever get into a situation where everybody thought the central bank was going to do one thing and the central bank fooled everybody and did something else and totally messed them up. Right? And Friedman saying that in general, you don't want that to happen. Okay. So these guys, market monetarists, they're going to, as we're going to see in a second, they're going to focus on the monetary authority's role in providing macro stability and growth over time. And it's going to be very compatible with this old school monetarist approach, but it's not the same thing. We'll see in a minute why it's different. This term market, that has to do with the fact that these guys are, generally speaking, very free market economists. Now, they're not free market compared to Murray Rothbard or Walter Block, but they are free market compared not just to Paul Krugman, but also even run-of-the-mill economists. So in particular, a lot of these guys were trained at Chicago, and like Scott Sumner was, for example. Right? And so that's also explains the affinity with Milton Friedman, who, of course, was a famous Chicago school economist. Okay. Why don't I, in the interest of time here, let me move on. So what their actual proposal is various versions of what's called NGDP targeting. So you guys know what GDP is, gross domestic product, but this N, in case that confuses you, that stands for nominal. Okay, so the idea is they're saying the ideal monetary policy is such that nominal GDP grows at a fixed percentage every year. Okay, so you can see how this is similar to the old school monetarist approach, but it's not the same. The market monitors are not saying let M2 or M3 or M1 or the monetary base grow at a certain percentage per year. That's not what they're saying. They're saying make nominal GDP grow a certain amount. So what nominal GDP is, it's the total amount of expenditures not adjusted for changes in the price level. And let's put aside Austrian quibbles about those concepts. I just want you to at least understand what these guys are saying. Okay, so normally, when you read the financial press and it says, oh, this quarter GDP grew at a 2.2% annualized rate, they actually mean real GDP. So it's not just that they're saying, oh, it's not just like the total spending on final goods and services went up by 2.2%. No, the total spending on final goods and services, maybe it went up by 4%. But prices in general, according to some index, went up by 1.8%. And so real GDP only went up by 2.2%, something like that. Okay, so what Scott Sumner and the other people in his camp are advocating is saying don't focus on real GDP. Focus on nominal GDP. And it's not because they agree that real GDP is more important than nominal GDP. Okay, so they would agree that if you had to pick and say, would you rather live in a world where real GDP was growing at 2% a year or in a world where all you knew was that nominal GDP was growing at 2% a year, which would you pick? They would realize, well, who knows what's going on in that world with nominal GDP growing, that the important thing is the actual production of real goods and services. But the point is the central bank cannot directly control real GDP. If the government raises income taxes to 98%, the central bank is not going to be able to prevent real output from falling off the cliff. Okay, or if you're a small island country and then some other country blockades you because there's a war, doesn't matter what your central bank does, people are going to start starving. All right. So Sumner is saying what the central bank can do is control the amount of total spending. And that's the thing that we want to target. All right. Just like with Milton Friedman and his thing about have M2 grow at 5% a year or 3% a year or whatever. It wasn't because Friedman thought people directly care about how many dollar bills there are and the quantity of checking account balances. It's that he knew that that was a credible commitment. The central bank, Friedman thought, could control the growth of M2. Because if M2 is growing too quickly, they can just sell off assets and suck dollars out of the economy or vice versa. Okay, so the point of focusing on nominal stuff from the market monetarist point of view is because the central bank can do it if they're committed enough. Okay. So by doing that, Sumner says that will keep the central bank from introducing monetary disturbances, and that's the most you can hope for. Okay, so what's their diagnosis of our recent troubles? Sumner, and this was amazing, and it's partly why I'm saying he's such a threat, if you will, since I think he's totally wrong in his policy views, is that I encountered Scott Sumner when he was not popular at all. It was like Tyler Cowen at Marginal Revolution would link to him, and he was like this idiosyncratic guy that Tyler liked, but that very few people had heard of. You know, he wasn't at some big school. It was at Bentley University. What the heck is it? I haven't even heard of it. Okay, and it was, and since, well, late 2008, Scott just kept, well, I think maybe 2000, I can't remember when he started, but he started maybe 2009. But anyway, in the beginning, very few people read him. Like I said, it was just Tyler kind of occasionally linking to him. And I was sort of reading him almost just like, because it was funny, like he was a character, because he had such an odd perspective. And then it just, he's got immensely popular and like became within economic policy wonk circles, literally world famous. Okay. Such that like Janet Yellen and people like that, they might not have referred to Scott Sumner by name, but they would refer to nominal GDP targeting. And Sumner did more than just about anybody to just keep hammering at that idea for the last 5 years and really bring it to the forefront. Okay. So that's partly why I'm focusing so much on him right now with you guys, is I just want you to be aware of this, that going forward, I think this is really the chief rival to the Austrian approach to money and banking and business cycle. Okay. So what is the wackiness of Scott Sumner's approach? Well, he takes his views seriously, excuse me, and so he's saying, all right, if what the Fed is supposed to be doing is to ensure stable growth and nominal GDP, well, then look at what happened since 2008. This blue line is actual at GDP. See, look at it was growing nicely, and then it fell off a cliff, and then it has not gotten back to its original trajectory. So even though the rate of growth eventually recovered, there's this permanent gap, this shortfall between where nominal GDP ought to be and where it actually is. And so on that metric, Scott Sumner is saying Ben Bernanke had the tightest monetary policy since Herbert Hoover, or since the Hoover administration. I mean, he knows Hoover wasn't directly running the Fed. But his point is, if you look at it from the perspective of nominal GDP growth, the last time we saw something, a collapse this dramatic and this persistent, was in the early 1930s. And so now we see the direct tie-in why Sumner thinks he's just the natural outgrowth of Milton Friedman, is because Milton Friedman also diagnosed the early 1930s depression as being the fault of the Federal Reserve. Because what according to Friedman, what happened is there were banking panics, you know, the stock market crashed, banking panics, and the quantity of money shrunk because of the fractional reserve banking system. As people went to the commercial banks and withdrew their deposits, the overall quantity of money shrank. And so, like M2, if you looked at M2, that would have fallen by like a third between like 1929 and 1933. I'm ballparking those figures. Those are roughly correct. All right. And so in Friedman's mind, since the optimal thing to do would be for the central bank to ensure the steady growth in the quantity of money, let's say M2, since the Fed just sat back and let M2 collapse, during the early 30s, Friedman's saying, oh, see, that's the sense in which the Fed was asleep at the wheel and didn't do enough. So if you see, there's actually a consistency to it that you might think it's weird, and an Austrian Rothbardian certainly do think it's weird to imagine that the Fed needs to come in and save things. How could it be that its failure to inflate sufficiently? But if you're thinking of the things the way Milton Friedman was and thinking the optimal policy of steady and predictable growth rate in M2 or some other monetary aggregate, since that collapsed, he's saying the Fed fell asleep at the wheel and didn't do its job. Okay, so notice there, the Fed in the early 1930s was not purposely destroying money. It's not that their avowed goal was to have M2 fall. Okay, M2 was falling because the public was panicking and they were going to the banks and taking out their deposits. And I'm assuming most of you guys know this, but I just want to make sure I'm not losing anybody. With fractional reserve banking, if you take out your deposits from the bank, the total quantity of money in the account shrinks. Okay, because they had multiple checking account balances pyramided on top of the cash that was in the vault. Okay, so if Milton Friedman was saying, yeah, I know the Fed wasn't actively seeking to shrink the quantity of money, but there were other forces in motion that were doing that, and the Fed didn't intervene to offset them. So Scott Sumner says the same thing. He understands. He's not saying Ben Bernanke was sitting around with his advisor and said, hey, let's make NGDP fall. But he's saying NGDP fell for some reason, and the Fed didn't do enough to offset that. And that's all that counts when it comes to monetary policy, is what actually happened. Or what do people think is going to happen? Okay, very quickly, because we're running out of time here, just so you know, why should NGDP matter? Scott Sumner says it's because people write long-term contracts. Like they buy houses, they borrow money, and contracts are denominated in terms of actual dollars. And so if all of a sudden, you know, one way of thinking about NGDP is like gross income, nominal income. Okay, if nominal GDP is how much everybody's spending on something, well, that means that's how much everybody's receiving. And so one way of looking at this, Scott Sumner would say, is that people like at this point, back in 2007, they were signing long-term contracts, buying houses, committing, you know, to mortgage payments, and workers were signing labor contracts with their employers and so forth, locking in nominal things and thinking that, you know, nominal income was going to grow like this, but instead it's down here. And so they think so Sumner would argue there's a sense in which the total amount of nominal income being earned is a lot less than what people aggregate thought was going to happen. And so how does that show up? Well, that's why there's a recession. Everybody's cutting back. Okay. That's the idea. Okay. So the Austrian response to all that, first of all, I mean, I just want to say that this is the chart of the monetary base. This is a measure of what the Fed has done. And so I want to say, okay, according to Scott Sumner, to explain why from this point on we had a really bad economy was that the Fed had the tightest monetary policy since the early 1930s. When this happened, when the Fed pumped in more than twice as much money as had happened up from the creation of the Fed to that point. And so, you know, just sort of naively, I want to say, come on. If your worldview spits out that what's happened since 2008 is that the Fed has been too timid, come on. That can't possibly be right. Another metric would be to look at interest rates. And the Fed, of course, has cut interest rates down to basically zero and held them there for years. Also unprecedented. Okay. Now, Sumner has his reactions to that, and in the interest of time, we can't get into that, but I'm just saying that's one obvious response. Another thing is to say it's relative prices that matter. That here, Sumner is relying on just aggregates. He's saying ultimately the thing that keeps the economy on track is this percentage increase in nominal GDP. But from an Austrian perspective, you could say, no, there's all sorts of relative prices and things at a smaller disaggregated level that matter. And ultimately, according to the Austrian, the business cycle is caused by the fact that, you know, why is there a recession? So guys like Scott Sumner and Milton Friedman say, oh, the reason there's a recession is that for some reason spending was inadequate. And in this sense, they're Keynesian, and Sumner doesn't have a problem with this. Sumner admits that if what Keynesian means is that you explain a recession by pointing to a drop in aggregate demand or insufficiency in aggregate demand, then he agrees that, yeah, his perspective is Keynesian. So they're saying even Friedman and Sumner agree the reason there's a recession, typically, is that spending has fallen for some reason. At least if the recession is because of the monetary authority. And so the monetary authority needs to come create more money and get spending back up. Whereas from an Austrian perspective, no, it's the reason there's a typical recession and a typical boom-bust cycle is that that's the necessary consequence of the preceding boom period. And so the solution is not, from an Austrian point of view, the solution is not to raise the absolute price level or the absolute amount of spending. The solution is to not have the improper relative prices of the boom period. Because what happens in the boom period specifically is that interest rates are too low, and so that makes certain projects seem profitable when really they're not, or they shouldn't be. And so entrepreneurs start investing and expanding certain operations that are not sustainable. Okay, so you see here how, tying back to what Roger Garrison was saying, if you're using a capital-based macro framework, that sort of story makes sense. Whereas in Scott Sumner's story, capital doesn't even show up. I mean, he knows capital exists, and he knows there are capital goods, but that's not really an important part of the story. He can tell his story just in terms of nominal aggregates and, you know, reference to the empirical fact that labor contracts are sticky and that nominal debt contracts are based in terms of nominal figures. It's not that you get to readjust how much you owe the bank based on CPI or something like that. Okay, so that's how Scott Sumner tells his story. For him, it's about aggregate movements. And so if total spending is too low, well, you just need to goose total spending. Problem solved. In the Austrian story, if the reason there's a crash is that the underlying capital structure is misallocated and sort of out of whack, you can't fix that just by dumping in a bunch of money, which is why doing this doesn't help. Okay. Modern monetary theory. So we're moving on now. Or they just go by MMT. So here, in terms of placing this in the history of economic thought, one of the forerunners of these guys is Abel Lerner in what he called functional finance. And there's also what's called Chartalism. Not charlatanism. Chartalism. And so they, if you read a lot of these guys' work, you'll see that it sort of anticipates what is now called modern monetary theory. Probably the best single known representative of this today is this guy, Warren Mosler. I did debate this guy at, where were we, Columbia? Yeah, Columbia last summer. It's on YouTube if you want to look at it to get a sense of where these people are coming from. Okay. Incidentally, this guy is a super nice guy, very charming and everything. So he's fun to watch. But again, these views are odd. Let me quickly introduce you to MMT thinking. So the way you'll see this expressed, and this too also is a little bit of a challenge to the standard Austrian views, because I have seen plenty of people say things along the lines that, yeah, the Austrians say how economy should be, but the MMT guys tell me how the economy actually is. All right, and so the MMT people have done a wonderful marketing job of getting that out there. And if you watch the debate, you'll see that's the way they tried to couch it, is to say, yeah, Murphy, you're telling me that, you know, you wish there wasn't fiat money and you wish we had gold or commodity money, and you might be right. You know, this guy Moser was that was, if you watch the debate, you'll see that was part of the problem, is like he was agreeing with everything I was saying. And so I couldn't, it was hard to get clash, and then he was just saying, but, you know, maybe we should have a gold standard. I don't know. All I'm saying is right now we have fiat money, and so and then he would go into his analysis. And so rhetorically, it was very effective because it makes it sound like he's being real neutral, whereas on the ideologue, when, of course, as an Austrian economist, I would say, well, yeah, I think there should be a commodity money, but given that there's a fiat money, this is what the neutral objective Austrian analysis says is going to happen. And whereas he obviously didn't agree with that. Okay, but just to give you an idea of where they're coming from, Mosler has a very famous work called The Seven Deadly Innocent Frauds of Economic Policy. So that title, if you just study the terminology, so the seven frauds of economic policy, so these are going to be myths or things that are untrue that people believe about economic policy, and they're deadly, meaning this is really hurting our economy and our nation because people believe these false things. But he calls them innocent, because what he means is the people who believe in these things, they're not doing it because they're sinister. They're just doing it because they're ignorant. They're locked in old school gold standard thinking when these things would have been true. But now, Mosler is saying, we have modern monetary systems. We're not old school gold standard style stuff. Now, the way the modern monetary system works, we need to have an updated theory. Okay, so that's what modern monetary theory comes, that's where it comes from, that's what it means. All right, so ultimately, they're saying this is a body of economic thought that's applicable to a world where governments have fiat money. And so if that's, and especially if they don't have debts that are denominated in other currencies. In that sort of world, they're saying these seven things that would have been true under the gold standard are not true anymore, and policymakers need to realize that. Okay, so just to give you some of that, government spending is limited by its ability to tax or borrow. So Mosler is saying that would have been true under the gold standard. It's not true now, because you can just print money. Social Security is broken, right? So Warren Mosler and other MMT theorists don't like it when so-called fiscal conservatives will say, oh, Social Security is broke. There's no money there. It's trillions of dollars of unfunded liability. They will say with a straight face, what are you talking about? We have a printing press. How can it be? You know, Uncle Sam cannot go broke. Right, the U.S. Treasury never needs to default on any of its bonds because they can just print more dollars and hand them to the bondholder. End of story. That is their position. So you can see, on the one hand, you can't argue with that. Well, yeah, right, that's true. You see what I'm saying? they're saying that that's a great insight, and that, you know, hey, we're just explaining this is fiat money. We never need to default. The government never needs to default on its bonds. It can always just print more money. And that's, so you see the logic there and why they think when political candidates or people writing op-ed pieces in the newspaper, when they say stuff like, you know, we just can't afford to have all these wars in Iraq and Afghanistan because we've got all these unfunded liabilities and Social Security and Medicare, and where are we going to get the money to pay for all this? They think that that's nonsense. And they're saying, we know where you can get the money. We got a printing press. Okay. So the Austrian response to this stuff, since I'm running low on time, I think you can imagine what it's going to be. And this is what I said in the debate. Look, it's, yeah, of course, there's a sense in which, legally speaking, the government never needs to default. But still, when the government spends money, whether it raises it from through explicit taxation or whether it borrows it or whether it prints it up through the printing press, government spending money redirects real resources from other alternative uses. And so unless you think that politicians or bureaucrats know better than the decentralized market process where those resources ought to go, that makes us poor in terms of, you know, some sort of economic efficiency. And then in particular, in terms of the justness of it or the morality of it, obviously, I'm sure most people listening to this don't think that bureaucrats with access to a printing press that is only the monopoly currency because of legal tender laws and other sorts of things, that they have the ability to sort of commandeer resources by printing up more money. All right, so the MMT guys, they're not completely crazy or stupid. They will admit, oh yeah, if you print too much money, prices rise too much. But they're saying, you guys are focused on the wrong thing. It's not that the government has a budget constraint and that's why we got to make tough choices with regard to spending. Rather, it's we don't want to cause too much price inflation. So that's why we might not want to spend too much. And so for that, I would just say, okay, you push the problem back to a different area, but it's the same ultimate problem. And certainly, given the way the politics works in the real world, it's extremely irresponsible to be telling people, hey, don't worry about it. The government doesn't face a budget constraint anymore. That's gold standard thinking. We can just print money. That is going to lead to much more government spending and much higher price inflation than what they think is going to happen. Once you let that genie out of the bottle, it's going to be hard to control. Okay, incidentally, just because I spent way too much time making it, if you want to see, I made this YouTube video, you can see the link there where I went through. There was this guy in the crowd, Mike Norman, who hates Peter Schiff with a passion for some reason. And so this guy, you may remember him, he was on Fox News back in like 2005 or 6, laughing in Peter Schiff's face about there being a housing bubble and stuff. So this guy happened to be in the crowd at the Columbia debate when I was debating this guy, Warren Mosler, this guy Mike Norman, and he at the end just, you know, started laying into me and whatever. So anyway, and he made a video. So if you want to go look this up, you can see the whole funny affair. And also I will in there summarize the Austrian response to the MMT group. Okay, the last main objection comes from there's versions of it from Paul Krugman and Tyler Cowen. And so here the idea is they're saying, wait a minute, this Austrian story of the business cycle doesn't really make sense. There's a certain asymmetry involved that they claim that, you know, during a recession, what's happening is resources, workers and other resources have to get reallocated. There are certain sectors that expanded too much because of the artificially low interest rates. And then once interest rates got jacked up, because the central bank chickened out or whatever, price inflation was getting too high, then that caused a crash. And so now resources have to get reallocated back into other lines. Okay, so that's the standard Austrian story. And as to why an unsustainable boom leads to an inevitable bust and why unemployment shoots up, for example. So in normal recessionary period, unemployment's higher. And so the Austrians explain it the way I just did. So, Krugman had this fairly famous critique of that, and Tyler Cowen liked it, linked to it, where he said, wait a minute, that doesn't make any sense. There's an asymmetry. If unemployment goes up during the recession period when, like, workers are having to move out of housing and back into other sectors, well, then how come unemployment didn't go up during the boom period? Right? Because you Austrians are saying it was during the boom, like, let's take the housing boom and bust. You're saying that the Fed kept interest rates too low after the dot-com crash, like from 2000 to 2004. Interest rates were too low, and so that sort of pushed too many workers in the housing sector, among other things, in the finance stuff. But let's just focus on housing. And so they start building too many houses, too many real resources, wood and glass and shingles and stuff like that, bricks. Too many resources and workers got pumped into housing, and then it collapsed, and then those workers were out of work and so forth. They say, okay, well, how come you didn't see unemployment really high from like 2001, 2002 up through 2006 as all those workers were getting sucked from other areas into housing? And so he said there's a certain asymmetry there. All right. So as far as the Austrian response to that, first, like I say, for more here, to supplement what I'm going to tell you in the remaining few minutes, check out this article, and I'm calling it the sushi article. You'll see why. There's a big thing of chopsticks holding sushi, and when you read it, you'll understand why I call it that. And it has to do, again, with this idea of capital structure. But as a first pass, let me just explain it this way, because it's almost so easy, I can't believe that Krugman said it, and I can't believe that Tyler Cowen thought it was a great objection. Look, when during the artificial boom period, when workers get sucked into certain lines, what happens? Well, loosely speaking, it's like the central bank comes in and starts handing out money on really cheap terms to entrepreneurs who want to take that money, and then they go into the factor markets and they want to start long-term projects that were unprofitable before. So like some entrepreneur wants to start building a factory because now when interest rates are 1%, the factory is profitable on paper, whereas when interest rates were 5%, it didn't make sense to start that factory. Okay, so how's he going to – so you need workers to start building the factory. So how's he going to do that? Well, he's got to hire them from somewhere. So if we were in a regular economy beforehand, how is he going to get those workers to come work for him? He has to offer higher wages, better benefits, or whatever, so that workers right now who are already employed quit their jobs and go work for him. So that's why you wouldn't see unemployment go up during the boom period. You would see measured unemployment go down. Because when these entrepreneurs are getting this cheap money or cheap credit, they first are going to hire the people who are out of work. And then once that happens, and they start, you know, they have to start increasing offers to get other workers to quit their current position and come work there. And so at no point would you see an increase in a bunch of workers sitting around with no work. Right? Or at least you'd have to tell kind of a convoluted story to get that to happen. I mean, you could tell a story about optimal search and blah, blah, blah. But the point is, just at a very naive level, central bank's handing out money on really good terms, and the entrepreneurs have to bid workers away from what they're doing right now. So, and clearly, even if there is a sense, like if you watch a particular worker, if he is out of work for a while, it's because he quit his job looking for something new, right? And so even the workers who are out of work, it's because of optimism. It's because they realize there are better opportunities, right? In contrast, what happens in the bust? It's the opposite. In the bust period, that entrepreneur who was building that factory, let's say, when interest rates go back up, he realized, wow, this factory is not profitable. I have to scrap it. I got to stop the project, start selling off everything I can piecemeal and lay off all these workers. Okay, so now they're instantly out of work. They can't just move somewhere and start next week somewhere else. It's not like they're given their 2-week notice and they just got to rent a new apartment in a new city or something and start work the way it was during the boom. No, here they get laid off. They didn't see that coming. And now they got to start from scratch and look around. And also, the new job they take is going to be worse than the one they had because now the economy is worse. Everybody's poor. In general, people are poorer. And the reason a lot of people are looking for work is because what used to be their best option now dried up and is no longer an option. So now they got to go to their second best option. So in general, people are going to be more reluctant to take a pay cut. They're going to be a little bit, you know, they're going to be pickier and not want to do that as much as when they were employed. You know, the only thing that made them leave their job during the boom was the existence of this better offer. Okay, so just thinking through that logic, of course, you would see in the aggregate during the boom a lot of workers moving around and certain sectors expanding and other sectors shrinking. And that would all be consistent with an actual drop in the overall unemployment rate because the expanding sectors would first draw down the excess workers who are out of work, and then it would just start sort of siphoning off the workers from other lines. Okay, but in the bust period, a bunch of industries, a bunch of sectors lay everybody off, and so that pool of idle workers grows. And then it's only over time that those workers look around and finally lower their expectations and take some jobs somewhere just because they can't keep living without a paycheck. And that finally that unemployment rate, or, you know, that pool of unemployed workers gets whittled away over time. And so on the face of it, I mean, there's nothing odd or asymmetric about that story. Okay, we've got about 10 minutes left. I'm not seeing you guys having posted any questions, so I can spend the next 9 minutes going over Ludwig von Mises' analogy of a home builder to drive home this point, unless you guys have something you want to ask me. So if something pops in your head, go ahead and type it up, but after that, or absent then, I'll go ahead with this analogy. Okay, let's see. Malcolm says, would you say that a mistake that the Keynesians, Marxists, mainstream economists make is not recognizing that money itself is a commodity, and thus they all bifurcate micro and macroeconomics, thus not recognizing that there is no bifurcation? I think that, yeah, that is true in a sense, I think. I'm not really sure. It's hard. I think a lot of them are just not very philosophically inclined. Well, Marxists are philosophically inclined, but a lot of the mainstream people, I just think they never even thought of it like that, that they've just been trained that this is the way you do the model. And I think you're right. There is a sense in which mainstream economists in particular are very materialist, maybe. I don't know if that's the right adjective, but they think there's something, I mean, just the very terminology, real as opposed to monetary. I mean, if you think about that, and I'm just using that because that's the terminology you're taught when you study economics, but if you think about it, that's kind of a weird distinction to make because it makes it sound like money's not real when there's a sense in which the most important commodity in the economy is money. And so it's kind of weird that you call that you make this distinction between real goods and services versus money. And so I think what you're saying, there's a lot of merit to or truth to it, that there is this bias in a lot of economists' minds that money prices are somehow artificial and that the underlying, you know, hard, real reality is the physical goods and services, and that money is just like a matter of accounting. And so it kind of goes back to, And the Austrians, more than any other school, avoid that trap. That Mises in particular, you read Human Action, and he just pounds over and over the fact that it's money prices that allow for economic calculation, and that is a grave mistake in economic theory to think that you can solve the economy thinking of a barter framework and then just as an afterthought overlaying money prices. He's saying that is a fundamental mistake that even top flight economists continued to do, as of when he wrote Human Action, and they still do it to this day, where they don't think in terms of money. They actually, the way they think of the world, even Nobel Prize winning economists to this day, they think of the world as a barter economy. That's the way their models work. And then even economists who have money in the model, money is not doing in the model what money actually does in the real world. The way they get it in, it's like they have people hold money the same way somebody would hold a Van Gogh painting, that just the mere possession of it gives them utility, when obviously that's not really why you hold money in the real world. Okay, let's see. Phil Boggs says, what is Mosler's point? So he's talking about Warren Mosler, the MMT guy, about the zero return rate on a monopoly good. Okay, if you go and watch that debate that I had with him, there was this point he brought up. And I'll confess, Phil, I was never exactly sure what he was saying. I think it was something like this. I think Mosler was saying, look at, if we had, like just standard price theory says, if the marginal cost of something is zero, then we ought to just keep producing it until we've satiated everybody, right? And that it's, so like if somebody monopolized the supply of oil or something, they would, standard price theory would say that they would hold too much of it off the market. And then if you split it up and gave it to different people, then there would be more output or whatever, consistent with the competitive level of output. And so I think what Mosler was getting at is that with fiat money, if there's a positive interest rate, nominal interest rate in terms of the money, that kind of reflects the fact that the central bank is being too greedy or too stingy, that they ought to be printing more money to the point at which the nominal interest rate gets pushed down to zero, because it doesn't actually cost real resources for them to print more money. I think that's what he was getting at. And so he was agreeing with me that maybe under a gold standard, nominal interest rate should be positive because it takes real resources to dig up more gold. But he's saying once you've got fiat money in the government printing press, to have nominal interest rate being positive like reflects an artificial scarcity. I think that's what he was saying. Okay, Jorge says, how would you describe Janet Yellen's theory behind Fed policy? Market monetarism, but shy, or classical monetarism? Unfortunately, I don't know enough about Janet Yellen to say with confidence, so I probably should just skip that one, sorry. Okay, John says, oh, he's just networking. He wants me to contact him. Okay, I'll do that, John, after. Thank you. Okay, let's see. Malcolm says, and this will be the last one. We got like 2 minutes left. Malcolm asks, why do you think those that start out as Austrians abandon or dismiss the Austrian school? One example is Tyler Cowen. Yep. And then another one would be Brian Kaplan. Just be careful, Malcolm, though, that article you linked, that's Brian Kaplan, it's not Tyler Cowen. But it's also true that Tyler Cowen, at one point, I don't know if he called himself an Austrian, but he was definitely very sympathetic to the Austrian school. Well, I think I know Brian fairly well, and I vaguely know Tyler. They're both really intelligent guys, and they read a lot. I think part of what happens is when you're younger, and you get introduced to economics, the route that you come through when you're younger, you think that that's the whole universe. And then as you get out more and you meet different people and you mature, and so you realize, oh, wait a minute, there's other perspectives. And so for some people, they just, I don't know, they recoil from the stuff that they used to like a lot when they were younger. And so I don't know what to tell you beyond that. I mean, it's not just with, I mean, it's with everything. You know, there are people I know that just adored Ayn Rand when they were 18, and then they went through a period where they just couldn't stand her and hated her, and then maybe as they got older still came back around to her. Just so you know, I had a similar thing. When I first got to grad school and I saw all these really sharp people, where I actually doubted some of the stuff that I had believed in undergrad, because for a while, like, these guys were so smart and everything at NYU. But then I realized, oh, wait a minute, they're really good at math, but actually I don't think they're good economists. And then I kind of, you know, in my mind came back to my senses and then went back to calling myself an Austrian, because I realized the Austrian school is where I think all the important insights are. Okay, so I think it's that sort of process. Okay, guys, I'm showing that we're at time on my end here, so thanks for tuning in. And I'm sure you will learn much more from the other lecturers as well. Okay, thanks, everybody.